You're not.
Well, as you see, yeah, I'm not the governor. As you see, the substitute teacher is in today. And I have a lot of questions on virtually every item on the agenda.
I think you're
here. They don't. So, yes, the governor is not here today. He is in Washington meeting with federal officials on various issues, including our meeting with our Secretary of Health and Human Services on ACA and other issues. And so I am the substitute and am here, and I'll turn it over to the treasurer for comments.
Thank you, Governor. We certainly wish our governor well in Washington. We wish everyone in Washington well and hope they can get their acts together. I have nothing to say except to thank again Secretary Belden and congratulate him. We all were in Dorchester County last week. A wonderful celebration. Wonderful celebration. The opening of the Harriet Tubman Visitor Center and wonderful reenactment of Harriet Tubman and terrific music from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore Choir and Brass, and some very fine speeches from dignitaries who were there and the community. And one thing that really hit me thinking about it afterwards, Mark, was that it really was a community effort. I mean, there were people standing, white people, black people, other people, all there together on behalf of the community for this really meaningful event. And a great deal of planning went into it, and it went very smoothly and very memorably. And I thank you.
It was very good, very impressive. And I encourage all of those here to go to the park and take in the visitor center. It's very informative. It's part of our history of Maryland and the history of the United States.
It's got a great start, Lieutenant Governor. We had 6,000 visitors that first weekend.
Excellent.
Yes,
a terrific.
Yes, no, I support what the treasurer just said. I was down there, and it was just as cold there as it is today.
Maybe a
little
colder.
It was chilly down there, but the speeches were great, and I noticed that the Lieutenant Governor had to stand up after five brilliant speakers had gotten up, each of them individually, including the governor, who all spoke eloquently. And all of a sudden, he had to back clean up to all that. And I'm happy to report you did a very admirable job.
Thank you. I
did not envy you having to get up and follow all of that brilliance. But it was a special day. And if I could just report on this year's tax season. The Comptroller's Office employees continue to work diligently to process Marylanders' tax returns in an efficient and timely fashion. To date, we've processed more than 1.4 million tax returns. We have disbursed more than 1 million refunds, well over $1.5 billion, to Maryland families. We're averaging 3 business days upon receiving a Marylander's tax refund requests and putting their money back in their bank account. And I just want to salute my employees. I continue to be proud of their commitment to the vast majority of Marylanders who pay their taxes on time, appropriately, under the honor system, frankly. And in return for that, we try to make the filing process as easy and convenient as possible. We continue to work diligently to assure that all citizens, businesses, and companies are paying their fair share in taxes. And I'm proud that we continue to, reward the honest taxpayers, the vast majority in the state, by being very vigorous and aggressive with taxpayers who do not follow the laws of the state. And tax fairness for me is not an abstract concept. It's a driving principle. That's why my agency, and I have to admit I'm a little personally reluctant to do this each year, but we released our annual Caught in the Web list comprised of our state's top tax evaders. This list includes 25 businesses and 25 individuals owing more than $15.7 million in unpaid taxes, penalties, and interest. We are going to publish their names on the website for 6 months or until payment has been received or a payment plan has been set up. Since the program's inception several years ago, our agency has collected nearly $43 million in refunds and for these in tax compliance. And for those individuals and businesses that purposefully evade taxes, ignore our efforts to work with them, continue to cheat their neighbors and their state, we're going to use every tool at our disposal to collect the money that is rightfully owed the state. And I emphasize the vast number of businesses and individuals on these lists, which we do annually, have the resources. It's not that they don't have the money. They just have lots of lawyers, and they're all, for their own reasons, basically thumbing their nose at the state. So in the next few months, it's my hope that every name on the list will have either paid in full or contacted my office to establish a payment plan. Whether it's tomorrow, next week, or 3 to 4 months from now, we will collect what's rightfully owed. And the thing I love about this caught-in-the-web, I guess, public posting is that it is unbelievably effective because as soon as we put the names up, we get all sorts of phone calls saying, get me off that list because my wife doesn't like it or my husband doesn't like it or my family doesn't like it or my businesses don't like it. And so it's effective and it works, although you can imagine it's a little bit, I'm a little reluctant to do it because it is a public exercise. But this is after years of communication. Nobody's surprised by being on this list. We tell everybody they're going to be on it. We've garnished their wages. We've attached their assets. We've put liens on all their properties, everything. But they're so protected by the court system, I guess, that they're we just can't get through. So this is the last-ditch effort. And we are pretty sure that 50% of them will comply very quickly, which is good. And thank you for putting up
thank
with
you.
That.
No, and thank you for reminding me to get my taxes done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I usually wait till like the 1st of April to do that. So.
Yeah, well, that's for those of us that owe money, that's pretty normal, but...
Right.
I was just thinking that if I'm sitting next to the substitute teacher, here I am, the tax collector. It's a pretty gruesome group up here, I guess, that we're voicing on the public. But it's a pleasure to be with you, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you for running this meeting.
Okay, thank you.
It seems to me just off the cuff, I shouldn't say this because it's off the cuff of my head, with the federal IRS budget being cut, so and all this news going out that they're not following up, tax delinquents becomes even more important, I would think.
Yeah, no, I
for
think
us,
the...
And if that includes public shaming, I mean, that's...
Well, as I say, it rewards the honest taxpayers who are 99.9% of the public. It's just they do the right thing, and it's as I said, it's on the honor system. We're not able to get out everywhere. And so we're essentially saying to them, you guys do the right thing. Here are some people, most of whom have a lot of money, who don't do the right thing. So we're aggressively going after them. Thank you, Madam Treasurer.
Okay. All right. Before we get started with the agenda, I see we have Greg James here, the Deputy Secretary for Department of Human Services, to come and talk about a concern that was expressed in the last board meeting.
Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, thank you for allowing me to appear before you today. When the board last met, you asked us to come back and provide an update on our efforts to deal with placements at the Judge Rottenberg Center and indeed all of our out-of-state placements. And we committed to give the board an update, and I'm happy to be here today to provide that. Since we last met, there's been a considerable amount of activity on this, and I first want to stress that our efforts have not just been at the Department of Human Resources. We've identified this is not just only a DHR challenge. This is a challenge for all of the human services agencies within the state of Maryland to ensure that we have an appropriate continuum of care for the children that we serve. The reason that children go out of state is typically because we do not have a program that has available space at the time of placement to serve the needs of those youth in state. So we have been in close contact at the leadership level, Secretary Schrader, Secretary Padilla, Secretary of Ed, Superintendent Salmon. We've all been in contact, working together to identify placement alternatives for the youth who are at JRC and looking for ways to bring those youth back to Maryland. When we last met, there were 5 youth at JRC, and we had another 3 that were slated for placement there soon. As of today, we still have 5 youth there, but the 3 that were on track to go there, we are no longer planning to send there. We've identified 1 potential in-state placement option for one of the youth, and for another, that youth is on track for a treatment foster care placement, and we're working on other in-state alternatives for that 3rd youth. I should also mention that we had 2 other youth from another program in Maryland that were on track to go out of state. When those came to the attention of the Secretary, she immediately reached out to Secretary Schrader, who reached out to Deputy Secretary Simons at the Developmental Disabilities Administration, working in close collaboration with that Deputy Secretary and Deputy Secretary Bazron at the Behavioral Health Administration. We were able to identify a strategy to allow us to keep those 2 youth in Maryland as well. So that's 2 additional youth who will not be going out of state. On Friday the 10th, we had an interagency meeting with a number of providers in Maryland, existing providers, as well as some providers that have been identified by the Developmental Disabilities Administration who are interested in expanding capacity in-state. We did a case review, and the local departments, the local caseworkers who know these children, know their challenges, were present and went through and presented those cases to the assembled body. And we were able to identify 2 potential in-state placements for 2 of those youth with existing DHR providers. We are working with 2 existing DDA providers for additional placements for those for 2 additional youth. For the 5th youth there, it's an older female who has been working very, very diligently to complete her high school diploma. And at this point, it's the best judgment of the caseworkers that we need to make sure that she has an opportunity to get that high school diploma. So we're working on strategies to ensure that, whether that's remaining at Judge Rodenberg Center through August when she'll complete her degree, or trying to find an in-state alternative that will not disrupt the progress that that young lady is making towards graduation. I'd also like to stress that we have had staff visiting that program in Massachusetts every week. They've been going up, visiting all of the youth to ensure that they're safe and there have been no incidents of maltreatment. In addition to our immediate focus on bringing those youth back to Maryland, we are also laser-focused on bringing up additional resources in the state to avoid future out-of-state placements and to address these needs. So, as I mentioned, the Deputy Secretary Simons at Developmental Disabilities Administration has already reached out to 2 providers who have facilities in the state of Maryland, you know, homes, or other facilities that are ready to begin operations. They are interested in standing up and opening up 3 or 4-bed small programs that are specifically targeted serving the needs of these youth. The timeline for that, for them to staff up and go through training, is roughly 60 days. and that's what we're working on with them to bring those programs online. By the end of this month, we will also be starting an interagency work group to bring together all of the child-serving agencies, the departments who are involved in licensing these programs, so that we can work together for a comprehensive Maryland strategy to stand up additional programs very rapidly to address the specific needs of these youth. And that work will start by the end of this month. The process of standing up new programs will continue throughout this year, but it's our goal to have those new programs created as quickly as possible so that we can reduce the need for out-of-state placements to the absolute minimum. I'd also like to mention that as part of our interagency efforts, we do vetting of any program that we use. We contact the local licensing authorities and ensure that the programs are appropriately licensed and they are in good standing. We do monitor for that, but we realize that even with all of those things, there's things that perhaps are known within the larger human services community that don't come to the attention of the media or that licensing agencies might not mention. So we have started a process of engaging with our sister agencies who also have considerable experience with these programs to provide us additional vetting of these programs. So we will no longer place a child at any program that we have not also thoroughly vetted with all of our sister agencies on the off chance that they have additional information that we don't have going in and that we have the best possible understanding of what's involved in those programs going forward.
If I could just, I first of all applaud the update because this is an unbelievably difficult and challenging issue that you're confronting, and I applaud the fact that you're taking steps because I think obviously it's better to have these kids in Maryland under your direct supervision rather than in Massachusetts or other states where even in facilities that are not in the press where there's been abuse and kids being beaten, but as you say, it's hard sometimes to remotely monitor, and I appreciate the weekly visits, but nonetheless, they're out of state. And so my hat's off to you for addressing a problem that I think Maryland is a wealthy state, obviously is capable of providing a solution for these kids in state. And so within the context of this being a painstaking analysis of the current situation, I applaud you for that. I do wonder whether you could send the board a letter, perhaps, just itemizing the timeline on the five kids in the Massachusetts facility, because I don't want to, as long as you're convinced that there's a plan to get them back in Maryland as soon as possible, that is set for the fifth, which has some educational component to it. That's great. And then give us some timeline on kids in other states, in other programs or other facilities, perhaps, that also, under your comprehensive review, are going to be coming back to the state where we have a higher level of accountability. Is that possible to put that in writing to us just so that we have it? It's more or less what you said. I just couldn't follow everything.
I will be happy to provide you additional updates in writing and keep the board updated on the progress with those youth. I apologize. I did bring a written report for you that goes into more detail.
Great.
And so I'll be happy to provide the board with regular updates on our progress. We look forward to coming back with more good news.
Excellent.
Mr. How long have you been in the human services in Maryland?
So, Madam Treasurer, I started out working as a policy advisor in the Ehrlich administration. I spent about 3.5 years there, usually working focused on DHR and juvenile services, and then transitioned up to Department of Human Resources as chief of staff and was there for about 8 months. I then went to the private sector and then came back, and I've been with the department since 2000, since the beginning of the Hogan administration. So it'll be 2 years now, yeah. Again, back with the department.
But in and out for 15 years.
Yes, ma'am.
The reason I ask this is not a gotcha or anything, and I appreciate all that's been done since our last meeting. I think it obviously is taken very seriously, but I've been here a little longer, and I've been involved with human services. I was there when the LJ case started. I mean, that's – and my sense is that every decade or two, we go through this same thing. Nancy Grasmick, when she was the head of the Office of Children and Youth, created a program called Get Them Back Alive, where we were bringing all of our kids back, and it was supposed to be the work of coordinated departments and agencies, because they're all our children. After kids were raped and beaten in a juvenile services home somewhere, brought them back. What is it? I would really appreciate hearing from you and your folks, and not today necessarily. What is we could do, since we thought we had an institutionalized policy for at least 30 years, maybe more, and good people who understood why we should do this, and yet maybe it's because every time we get to a budget cut, you have to cut back, or maybe it's because people find a very exceptional case and then another case that's not quite as exceptional, but the first person's there already, so we might as well build up. Whatever it is, based on your experience now, I'd be very interested in hearing what you think we could do to not only articulate a policy, bring the departments together, but then keep on it and make sure that we don't revert to the same process again. My observance has always been, I have nothing ideologically against outsourcing, but we never have the people to monitor an outsourced contract, and then something goes bad. So I'd really appreciate, and it doesn't have to be right now, some considered judgment, you and your colleagues.
So I think it's important to note that Maryland actually has made a tremendous amount of progress in reducing its reliance and bringing Maryland youth back, reducing our reliance on out-of-state residential programs. If you looked at the numbers for 20 or 30 years, our numbers have gone down dramatically, and the numbers today are dramatically different than they were when I was in state service 15 years ago. So I think at some point it feels as if we plateau. We reach a point where folks feel like we've gone as far as we can go. And I think that's a risk. And I think the other thing that perhaps we haven't had is a regular systemic evaluation of our continuum of care. And why is it when we look at the youth who are out of state, and some of this has been a data system issue. Our much maligned CHESI system at Maryland, at DHR, as bad as that system is, and I'm thrilled that we're replacing it, but frankly, our reduction of children in out-of-home placements overall within the state of Maryland, which has fallen by 50%, wouldn't have happened if we didn't have a data system like CHESI that allowed us to understand our kids. And even with the new data systems, with when CHESI came online, it was still a relatively limited set of information. So we're looking forward to getting better ways to analyze those cases. But even with data systems, a lot of it is just hard work and interagency collaboration and building a culture that says that's what we're going to do first, that's what we're going to do always, is work together and collaborate on these issues. And I think that's what our interagency work group is really focused on. It's not just about creating a handful of new programs to fill one gap in the continuum. It's about establishing a regular process and overhauling is the wrong word, but really restructuring our out-of-state placement process and our out-of-state review process, that it's not enough to just consider whether this one you should go out-of-state. You need to then come back on a regular basis and look at all of the kids out-of-state and say, wait, I see a pattern here. And if there's a pattern, there's probably a program that we should be creating. And that's what we need to look at. But I'm certainly not the greatest expert on human services within my department.
Whose bailiwick would that fall under if it's on a multi-departmental agency basis?
So this interagency work group is being convened by the Children's Cabinet. They came together and decided that they needed to make this a high priority. That was one of the major reasons why the Children's Cabinet was originally created. And I think it's important that we retain focus on this critical issue going forward.
So what can this board do to help you maintain that and increase it?
So, Madam Treasurer, if it's all right, I'd like to go back, and I think I should consult with the other folks from the Children's Cabinet, and we'll see if we can come back with
recommendations. But if it's a report, we used to get, like, quarterly or semi-annual reports from Dr. Grassmith on this thing, and it seemed to focus attention, but then things went smoothly, so we stopped doing it.
Yeah. Well, I think that's... Success is sometimes the worst enemy of attention
to
these matters.
So. I think it was great that the comptroller brought it up.
Yeah, no, now she's woken me up. And, you know, thank you, Madam Treasurer, for highlighting this. And I'd like to have the Deputy Secretary come to the next board meeting. You don't need to make a big presentation necessarily, but just be here in case we have some follow-up concerns, because I'm going to ask at every board meeting how we're doing on this, and I'm specifically now interested in other people. The Massachusetts institution that you're trying to get the kids out of, I mean, that's something where kids were beaten and abused and spat upon, and the press reported on it, and nonetheless, we were about to approve sending additional kids up there. So recently, the system has not worked very well. How many other kids are in other states' residential programs? Ballpark.
I believe the last count I had was 37 youth in out-of-state programs.
Okay. So,
I can
like
provide
to be,
more information on that.
Thank you. I'd like to have you, if you could, at the next meeting, come by and just let us know. That's the 37, including the 5.
Yes.
Okay. How we're doing on getting the 37 home, except in if you have some special circumstance that especially justifies this, because I think the treasurer brought a good point up, which is out of sight, out of mind. And if it's all working okay and there's no press and there's nothing, then nobody would ever put their hand up. But I think the ideal outcome, if it's at all technically possible, is to get every one of these kids home as soon as possible. And I guess the only way to do that is to ask every couple of weeks how it's going. Not necessarily like this, Lieutenant Governor, but if you could be here, that would be great.
Does it matter as much of him being here or submitting a report every 2 weeks or before every board meeting in terms of the status?
Just speaking for myself, at least initially, if we could have him come back in a couple of weeks, that would be terrific, because reports are wonderful, and the treasurer is very correct when she says we used to get reports, but I think this is something where I'd like to, if possible, and your schedule permits, come back and just be here in case we can get a further reduction of the 37. Because otherwise, I think it falls, I don't mean to say that people don't pay attention to reports, and this letter is terrific, and I appreciate it, but if you could come back 2 weeks from now, that would be great.
Absolutely.
You can probably do that.
It was my plan and expectation that I would be back here before the board every 2 weeks until the youth at JRC, that situation was resolved. So,
thank you.
But you're DHR.
Yes, ma'am.
this is not a problem isolated to BHR, right?
So the majority of youth in out-of-state placements are placed by DHR simply because we place more youth than anyone else. But
DJS,
we are working with DJS as well on this so that as we're looking to stand up programs, if there's a program that's going to be created that can also address the needs of their youth, then we'd like to have that taken into consideration and if there's a way for us to reduce their out-of-state placements as well.
Well, I think, I don't know whether it's a question of going back and talking to whatever the Office of Children and Youth is now, the cabinet.
Governor's Office for Children would be the
Governor's Office for Children. To get some idea of where we are in terms of Marilyn and her children, and not necessarily just one department's responsibility.
Yeah, we can look to see exactly where, you know, that data is residing. It would make sense that the Office of Children used to be called Children, Youth, and Families. I don't know why they changed that, but it's not me. But find out where that data resides so that you're equipped with it and we can bring in those who are involved, maybe the director of the Governor's Office of Children. She can come in as well and talk about what we're trying to do in that area.
Absolutely. The Governor's Office for Children does produce an annual report on out-of-state placements, and we can provide that
so we can get
to the board immediately.
Information. Okay.
Great.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Secretary, I'm going to change the order just a little bit, which is the privilege of a substitute teacher. And I'm going to ask General Services to present its agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for General Services. The department has 18 items on our agenda, including one supplemental, and we have staff available to answer questions at this time.
Okay. I half jokingly said I was going to go through each and every item, so I'm going to start with item number one, 1C Mod, Cheltenham Youth Facility.
Yes, for design and construction of a new youth detention facility, Lauren Buckler, Assistant Secretary for Design and Construction.
Hello, Lauren.
Good morning. For the record, Lauren Buckler.
My question is, it's a modification for installation and labor of lockers in the facility that is said that it was already included in the design document, but there was a change to the purchasing agent. Is this $80,000 the fee of the purchasing agent?
So the $80,000 was included in the budget. Typically, we buy equipment separately from the construction contract.
Mm-hmm.
We attempted to buy the equipment separately. We put it out for bid multiple times and received either single bids or no bids. So we moved it back to the construction project. The facility's open at this time, and they're operating without these lockers. So we moved it back to the construction project as a change order. So it's shifting money to that contract, but it's money that was already authorized as part of this project.
Okay. That wasn't explained, at least in the summary. Maybe it was in the backup, but it wasn't explained because it said the only difference was the purchasing agent. And that's... So you said you typically, I mean, this could have come in under a small procurement.
Small procurement commodities purchase is how we've
right.
traditionally done it. The volume of the lockers was not very high, so we were having a hard time getting competition, especially at the time we were advertising, because we were competing against new schools that were putting in
mm-hmm.
a lot more lockers and drawing the attention of locker manufacturers, and this small quantity was not drawing the bids that we needed.
Okay. All right. While you're there, item number three, I'm going to skip number two. So. Oh, you have a question on number two?
I did have a question.
Okay, good. Never mind.
No, it's not a... Why... number two is replacement and upgrading of lighting to LED systems?
That's correct.
Right? Why is there only one company? I don't get that. I mean, this is a very common thing to do in any large public-private building. Why would only one?
It could have been the timing that it went out. It could have been the size of the project wasn't attractive. You know, it was advertised to 333 vendors.
Right. I see all the things you went through, but it's $90,000 and a company that can go in and put in lights. I mean, is that what it is?
It's also at a correctional facility, which adds some challenges to vendors with clearances and timelines for getting into those facilities, so that does reduce some competition when we have those types of facilities.
I think one of the challenges in correctional facilities is they actually have to count their tools after
Correct.
When they're ready to leave, because you can't have a missing tool that could be used as a weapon.
And they have to be escorted, so there's additional times to get through security every time they come into a facility. They have to account for that timing with their staff. And they have to have staff that can meet the clearance.
And requiring background checks, is that a
yes?
Inhibition? And so there's this perfectly, relatively simple task that people don't want to get paid for doing. Maybe $90,000 isn't a lot of money to these companies. I would think it would be.
Maybe it's a sign that our economy is starting to do better. They're not hungry enough.
Yeah. So. And did you go back and ask them why they didn't respond?
Without receiving, we didn't get any responses for why people didn't submit bids. We got the one bid on it. It's
right.
Coming in at this point. It was processed an error internally.
No, so, I get all that. So I guess the answer is no, we didn't go back and find out why the others didn't.
To have that many people not bid, there could be multiple reasons why that didn't happen. It wasn't that there were bids that weren't qualified. It was people didn't bid.
Okay. It won't happen again, huh?
I would hope not.
Thank you.
Okay. Number three, 3M Mods, Johnson Controls. It's a relatively small modification, The question I have is that the original contract was $22,500, and it's now up to, including prior modifications, $268,000. Explain how we got to that point. You go from 22.5 to 268, almost 269,000.
So when DGS declared the emergency, we didn't know what was wrong. We knew that the air conditioning was not working correctly. What we put out and got some quotes on was diagnostics of what is wrong with the system. So the original price of $22,500 is under the Comar required emergency declaration of $25,000. But we declared it an emergency because we anticipated multiple change orders once the diagnostics were done. And then we could move forward with those diagnostic results. So this particular change order is related to the control system and fixing the modules on that system to ensure that the air conditioning will turn on at the correct times and turn off at the correct times.
So the 22.5 was just for the diagnostics, which
correct.
And then since you already had them in the system or in the building, you said, okay, go forward. Which building was this?
This is Central Services. So this is
right,
down the street.
Here,
this is the air conditioning for the whole Annapolis complex.
Okay. And it was declared at, okay. I guess there's no way of bringing somebody else in given that. Was this during the summer?
This was during the summer when this started. We've been slowly piecemealing. This isn't the only modification that's been done. As we find something, we fix that. We start it back up again, see if it's working, find the next thing to fix the next thing. So it's been an ongoing problem-solving case. We're hopeful that this is the final fix to this.
And that system also controls the Government House as well?
Correct.
Okay.
Government House, the State House, the legislative buildings.
So See, I would say that this building, we could go without air conditioning. They went how many years without air conditioning here?
Which is that, our office building?
This building.
Oh, this building.
The State House, this was built before air conditioning, but the First Lady and the governor would never let me cut off the air conditioning of the government house. So I understand that emergency.
Lieutenant Governor?
Yes.
I just want to applaud you for bringing that up. I had the same concerns, but you seem to be on top of it. But when exactly did the bid occur? Was that for the 22.5 or was that for the additional?
It was for the 22.5 is what the bid was for, and I believe that was back in October.
Okay. And oh, in October. We could have swung it at that point.
Yes, there was emergency was reported to the board on October 19th.
Oh, so it would have been before.
For a $22,000 contract. That,
right.
And they did have six bidders on the $22,000 contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But as you know, air conditioning is one of my favorite topics. And, I noticed last night that Baltimore County School Board voted to give the superintendent the authority over days that need to be closed. The classrooms need to be closed because of high temperature. And that's a big switch because obviously, the schools, he's on the other side of the issue as to whether the kids should be in those conditions along with the teachers. So, along with the other Baltimore County news, which is all over the place these days, it seems, but there were some other big news items up there. But this air conditioning issue at a school like Delaney High School, which now is gotten the renovation money is no longer there, so nothing's going to happen. That school needs portable air conditioning units put in the next several months, or the people in charge up there need to get out of office, because it is a disgrace that Delaney High School is in this position, and there are lots of other classrooms in addition to that. So, thank you for justifying your agency's budget. Sorry that the issue got brought up, but it is now front and center for Baltimore County to get this job done quickly. And if they don't, it's just administrative malpractice. And these kids are going to be in conditions that are just inhumane. So
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Baltimore Sun editorial page wants to get hold of me. They have their number, my number, because they disagree with me on this. But, Mr. Secretary Churchill, you guys, you know, continue to be, please, open to advising a recalcitrant county on what they need to do to protect their kids. And it's doable, and it should be done by the start of the hot days in May. Thank you.
Quick question on 8LT, the tenant lease, Maryland Veterans Administration, and
Assistant Secretary Wendy Scott Napier.
Good morning.
My quick question is, I see that this is for parking in downtown Baltimore for our veterans. We have veteran personnel in downtown Baltimore?
We do. It's a smaller staff, but they do have a location.
Where are they located?
I thought they were within proximity to the federal building.
Okay.
But I'll confirm.
Are they in lease space down there?
They are in lease space, yes.
Okay, we need to move them to 6th St. Paul, get them out of that space.
Okay.
Or they can even go to State Center. We have space there.
So, I will confirm.
We'd still need to pay parking if they're in 6th St. Paul, but if they're at State Center, we wouldn't have to do that.
Okay.
So let's work on that.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You should have been able to answer that. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, we're just handing off these different items. Item 9.
This is the comptroller's office.
Yes, I'm very happy to see this agenda item because this is a lease for taxpayer service office in Greenbelt that will allow our agency to better serve the residents Prince George's County with the type of respectful, responsive, results-oriented taxpayer service that we expect to provide. The nearly 2,500 square foot space will provide higher capacity, more functional space, opportunities for high visibility signage that simply isn't possible in our current Prince George's site that we're moving from. Our Landover office has served the agency well over the years, but this new space will allow us to take taxpayer service to the next level for the residents of Prince George's County. And I'd just like to thank DGS because, you know, when we asked them to review this, they moved very quickly and they've gotten a very, I think, appropriate, better functional space for us. And I just want to applaud the secretary.
I thank you, and I will echo that for our staff.
Yeah, you're a good realtor.
Real estate office does a very good job. 11 CGL.
Kathy Enzer with the grant program.
This is the Arthur Perdue Stadium, and I see we have Delegate Anderton here also. Are you here supporting the stadium or for the waterfowl?
All of them.
Tell us a little bit about the stadium project.
The grant is for renovation of the stadium project. We're still waiting for contracts, so at this point we're coming in just to approve the grant and the certify the match at this point. And I would
turn it over
and maybe get some more detail about the actual project. And
Well, we'll hear from Delegate Anderton.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Secretaries, staff, Madam Treasurer, I want to thank your staff for sending us these emails when we have items on the Board of Public Works agenda. It's very useful. Thank you. You get a high five virtually from me. Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller, thank you for this opportunity again. So this project here with Purdue Stadium is it's going to be take what already is a good asset and make it that much more. Because instead of it being used solely for what you would consider athletic events, you know, like the Delmarva Shorebirds who employ 200 of our citizens there, will now be able to be used as an outdoor amphitheater with individual seatings, high school, college graduations. I mean, the opportunities now fully expand beyond its current use by these upgrades. And so, you know, I'm greatly appreciative of your commitment. And I look forward to the final phase of funding that we're expecting very soon to complete the project. So that way it once again becomes a tremendous asset to not only the city of Salisbury, but Wicomico County and the entire Delmarva Peninsula, as well as the Ward Museum.
I was going to ask you.
Absolutely. It's phenomenal. We're going to have an opportunity now for the youth in our community to spend the summer learning about waterfowl things that encompass waterfowl, I guess. You know, I'm shooting from the cuff here as best I can. There's an item coming up that I also would like to touch on in the natural resources real property agenda, and that is for the Henry S. Parker Athletic Complex. We are moving a baseball field to make way to create more softball fields for the USSSA tournament that we host in the summer with about 500 teams that come through, and it's millions of dollars of impact on Wicomico County. And as we transition into more of a tourist destination inland Eastern Shore, it's a very vital project for us. And so I really look forward and appreciate and thank you for your support on that. And so it's a great day for Wicomico County. I'm blessed to be here, and I'm incredibly honored to have this opportunity.
Thank you.
Governor, Delegate, can I just say, I was reminiscing with the Deputy Treasurer. We were here in other roles when we started the Ward Museum.
Right.
And met the Ward Brothers Legacy.
Yep.
And it's just, I think it's a wonderful unknown treasure. Just like in some ways, the Baltimore Museum of Art nationally is not known.
Right.
even though it's a world-class institution.
Yeah.
The Ward Foundation, the Ward Museum, anything you can do or anything we can do to help you.
Absolutely. I mean, it is an awesome opportunity. I would encourage everybody to come by and visit. You know, having gone to school in Crisfield, at Crisfield High School, in the cafeteria, there was a big mural of Lem and Steve Ward that we used to sit in front every day. And it's very... very historical, integrated part of our community, our way of life, and
the Dorchester County last week, I think the shore, people are really coming to see that the shore is the heart.
Especially the inland parts of the shore. You know, everybody knows where Ocean City is. You know, everybody knows Route 50, but now people are starting to know where Route 413 is, and so that's awesome.
I congratulate you on this. This is great.
No, thank you. Yes, sir.
Well, I want to thank Delegate Anderton for being here. You can come back anytime.
I like it.
All positive, good stuff.
Absolutely. So, you know, you're in Salisbury so much that people think your office is there, your actual office is there. They call, hey, can I go see the comptroller today? I'm downtown. I'm down by the university.
Office 13.
Yeah.
Office right there.
I said, you can go by there, but I'm pretty sure he's in Annapolis. Let me
follow up, though, with your comments about the stadium, which is named after Mr. Perdue.
Absolutely.
And I think the vibrancy on the shore, at least as far as that stadium, which is one of the best in the minor leagues, and has been since it opened in 1996, it wouldn't even exist if Frank Perdue hadn't
made a huge contribution.
So he put millions of his own money into the stadium, and right next door, Salisbury University, his son, Jim Perdue, put up $8 million of his own money in 2006 to build the new business school. And I just want to indicate that I agree with the treasurer that the shore is a vibrant place, both on the coast and on the interior of the shore. It's a wonderful place, but it's got... the poultry industry plays an enormous role in being the engine that's driving some of that vibrancy.
Sure.
And thank you for reminding me of it coming forward on the stadium.
Right. I mean, I truly appreciate all your support, you know, and it's just that you can feel the change in the air when you're walking around Salisbury or Fruitland or Delmar's. The air is just lighter and people are excited. They feel things that are coming, and so it's just really... awesome to be a small part of that.
Thank you for your leadership. On that score. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
You too.
And I would be remiss to not point out that my daughter graduated last year from Salisbury University, and I spoke at her commencement, which was great. Didn't cry until I gave her the diploma. I was fine until then. Kathy, one more, or Ms. Ensner, one more thing. I wanted to just, and this is more from, I'd like to get contact with regard to 13 CGL, the grant to the Girl Scouts of Central Maryland, and it's for their Maryland Urban Program and STEM Center. And I would like them to contact us or either contact Diane Peters at our Department of Labor and Licensing. I am the honorary chair of the Million Women's Mentor Program in the state, and it's for encouraging women and girls to go into STEM fields. And we'd like to coordinate with the efforts of the Girl Scouts of Central Maryland with regard to what they're doing so we can provide mentors for them, women who are in STEM areas, to mentor some of these young girls.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Governor, could I also note that Delegate Rosenberg sent his strong support for this?
Oh, okay. I thought he was here.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think he's downstairs on the floor.
Oh,
but he would be here.
He would be here. Okay. Or at the Orioles games.
Or somewhere.
Yeah. That's where I see him often. And he scores a game.
Every, I guess he does.
Yeah. Any other questions from DGS?
No, good project.
There's the move. Do we have a second? I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, there we go. Madam Secretary.
Good morning, Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, we have 9 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 1 report of an emergency procurement, and we prepare for your questions.
I have a question about 5. Baltimore.
Right. I think Central Booking Secretary Jorgensen is here. This is the Baltimore Central Booking and Intake Center.
Right.
Award of a contract to PJ Dick.
Good morning. I'm David Bizanson, Assistant Secretary for the Department of Public Safety. Answer your question, sir.
Good morning. My question has to do with the program, Addicts Changing Together Substance Abuse Program. Do you know much about that you can explain to me?
I can give you a brief explanation as I...
Brief is good for now.
Okay.
I can follow up with the Secretary.
Let me find the program description.
The reason I ask while you're looking for that is because, as you know, the Governor and I have been very much involved with trying to address the opioid and addiction issues that we have in the state. And one of the places where we're confronted with that challenge is in our correctional facilities. And I know that there are a number of programs within our correctional facilities, and in some cases we're not able to get enough people through, and I know the Secretary has been working on this. But I just wanted to know a little bit. I was not familiar with this particular program and just there's
yes.
information.
This particular program serves a female population. And as you're aware, the governor closed the main men's detention center in August 2015. And we recently closed in October 16 the women's detention center and relocated that population to the central booking building. The program requirement to have a separate meeting area for this court-ordered program for treatment services for women was being performed adjacent to the Women's Detention Center in a trailer. The planned demolition of buildings would take those buildings down in the future, so we had to have a permanent location adjacent to Central Booking to serve that population. And that is why we are proceeding with this request to approve this contract. The program itself has been in existence for some time, and if you have specific questions about it, Kate Dixon, the Director of Capital Construction, is familiar with the needs of that program.
Okay. How is it working? How successful has the program been? First, I guess you need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm Catherine Dixon, Director of Capital Construction and Facilities Maintenance for the department. The program includes females that have drug treatment needs, and they're segregated from the rest of the population to focus on a full day of programming where they attend group therapy sessions, individual counseling, acupuncture services, and other services, which helps also shorten their sentence so they can be released when they complete the program.
Is there any kind of...
I have a three-page memo I could also send that goes into more detail about it.
Oh, please do, because I was going to ask the next question, and if there's any information that you can add, is there any handoff process when they're released? Because, you know, they...
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Recovery is an ongoing effort, and so, you know, the person can feel, okay, I'm ready, I'm the term sometimes is clean, but they come out and they still have the same stimuli that cause them to go to the drug culture in the first place. So is there any handoffs, some transition, sober housing, recovery housing, or something that can help them readjust and deal with the stimuli that might be there? If you don't know, you can get that information back to us. Okay.
There is, but all right. I don't think it's housing. I think it's with counseling.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Unless there's any questions? Other questions on the agenda? Questions on the Secretary?
Approval.
This is the Secretary's agenda.
Okay. No approval.
Thank you.
All in favor? Okay. Thank you. Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mark Belton, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 8 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
I don't have any questions. I do want to thank you again for the program at the Harriet Tubman Visitor Center. It was very well organized, and the visitor center itself was quite impressive.
Thank you, sir. Staff's very proud of it.
And if you would extend the thanks also to Ms. Satina.
I will.
Who did a terrific job.
Absolutely.
So I have a question about item six, if I could, Mr. Secretary.
Yes, sir. We have representatives here from the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy and the Maryland Environmental Trust, if you'd like me to call them up to answer your questions.
It's actually just a question for you,
sure.
I think, because when we originally approved this in February of last year, it was a $4.4 million easement acquisition that was 100% federally funded. It now appears that the federal funds were only $3.59 million, so we're being asked to make up the difference of $800,000 plus in program open space funds. I guess my main question is whether that would, if you were just asking us for the $809,000 for program open space, would this be a legitimate program open space item?
It certainly would, Mr. Comptroller. The Natural Resources Article 5-903E points out that DNR, with the approval of the Board of Public Works, may use acquisition funds to make matching or refundable grants to land trusts. And this particular property is an exciting addition to our public land system. The easement here is 678 acres right on the Sassafras River and one of its tributaries. It's a very ecologically sensitive piece of property, and it allows for access from the water for folks using those waterways.
Excellent. And is the are you going to provide a boat ramp or picnic area or hike or biker trail so that citizens really have access as opposed to just if you want to carry your kayak through the woods and put it in, fine. But
not at this particular time, but we will certainly be looking at that. It seems like it'd be a great spot for it.
Thank you for doing that, because I think sometimes we forget the families in our effort to protect ecologically sensitive land, particularly near water, and to the extent you can make sure that land preservation has community uses associated with it, I would be grateful.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Good. Well, keep us in the loop on that, please.
So the property is still an active farm?
It is.
Okay.
This is an easement. We won't be taking it over for active recreational use like a park.
And they will provide water access. That's
yes, sir.
Yeah, but the issue is one Mark put. I mean, Mr. Secretary, thank you for putting your finger on it. Hopefully, there's going to be a boat ramp and a trail, and not just
to make it more inviting for the folks
park
from the
along
water.
The side of the road.
Yeah, and walk through the cornfield or sort of bean field, and
we'll work on that with the.
Thank
results.
You very much.
Yes,
appreciate it.
Any other questions? We have a motion for this one.
Move approval.
I'll second that. Okay. All in favor? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Governor, Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, David Brinkley, the Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. We have submitted 8 items for today's agenda. I'm withdrawing item 2S, leaving 7 for your approval. I have representatives here to address any concerns or questions you might have. Item 7S mod has been revised, and item 8S is a hand carry item. It was deferred from our March 8, 2017 DBM agenda item. It was item 2S on that agenda.
2S you're pulling out. Okay.
So that was on that agenda item. And then 2S today is also pulled.
Okay. I have a question on 5S mod, health and mental hygiene. This is the courier service.
Yes, good morning. May it please the board, my name is Dana Dembro, Director of Procurement for the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. I'm not sure if Dr. Myers is... Oh, thank you. Come on up and join me, if you will. He's in charge of Laboratories Administration. This is a courier contract. It's an extension in order for us to complete the procurement for our new courier to be enforced by July 1st. And we'll be happy to answer any questions. Dr. Myers?
Now, this is courier services between where?
It's between the local health departments and the Laboratories Administration on a regular basis, 5 days a week. We make pickups of clinical and environmental samples that are brought back to our central lab in Baltimore.
They also function as an emergency courier system. For example, we had an Ebola case that occurred on Thanksgiving night a few years ago. We call up this company, and they actually dispatch a courier and expedite getting specimens back to us.
Okay. This is maybe a question in terms of just typographical. It mentioned samples between the local health departments and 201 West Preston. Your lab is no longer 201 West Preston.
That's correct. The central lab is now located at
7070 Ashland Avenue.
And that was
so
a typo.
This is a typo.
Yes, sir. You are very astute in catching it. I did as well, but it was too late to make the correction.
Okay.
It is our headquarters, so we let it go.
I look for typos, just to let you know. But I know where the buildings are located because of my former job, and I was questioning why 201 West Preston, a wonderful Soviet-era building.
We are kindred spirits. I look for typos as well.
Okay.
So,
but it's a wonderful new lab. The lab is right at the
store
of that over in East Baltimore, right in the Hopkins area. And it's a great location and a great building. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Other questions on this?
Dana, why don't you make the motion to correct the address for the record?
Oh, sure.
Can I ask a question? In the contract description, though, was it in 2012 at West Preston Street? Are you supposed to be advising in the modification?
The laboratory's administration used to be located.
I know, so the contract description might be correct. It's the modification description you need to update. So we'll update the item. We will work with that, Secretary.
So moved.
Make sure that the record is corrected. Thank you.
Good idea.
Yeah,
that is. All right. Do you have a question on
eight?
Item eight, Christy Michael and Dr. Salmon.
Hi.
Good morning. Nice to see you, Lieutenant Governor and Comptroller and Madam Treasurer. It's a pleasure, as always, to be before you today. And I do want to take an opportunity to thank the Comptroller for the number of questions that he asked at the last meeting, because it gave us some time to go back and really re-reflect, and I hope that we'll be able to provide those answers to you today to your satisfaction. And we look forward to any questions that you have. I'm going to bring up Christy Michaels with me and also Doug Schrader to address any of these questions.
Thank you, Madam Superintendent, and I didn't realize you were going to be here today, but that's terrific.
Always nice to see you, sir.
Yeah, no, it's very good to see you, and I saw you recently at the Blue Ribbon School gathering over at the...
We had a very nice dinner recognizing our six schools, and I thank you also for being there and staying and taking pictures as long as we did that evening.
Yes, that was... Well, they're just terrific people. Most teachers and principals seem to be having a good time. So I appreciate the letter sent to us by your deputy superintendent, Ms. Michael. I have still several serious concerns with the contract. First, and it's clear from the letter that you sent us, that there's nothing in the contract that would prevent test graders being hired, for example, off of Craigslist, as has been done by Measured Progress and their subcontractors in other states. With all due respect, I consider that to be a problem. In Maryland, we're better than that. I'm not prepared to approve a contract that has random people in Dover, New Hampshire, or New York, or Colorado paid $11 an hour grading Maryland tests when traditionally Maryland teachers do this. And are compensated, I think.
Talk a little bit more about this.
Sure. Good morning. For the record, my name is Christy Michael, the Deputy Superintendent for Finance and Administration at the Department of Education. Comptroller, you're correct that Measure Progress will use Kelly services to assist in finding graders for those assessments. They use a various number of methods to find folks to grade these tests. They do require, we require that they have a bachelor's degree. We have a preferred requirement that they have a degree in the content area that they'll be grading. There are some stringent processes that they need to go through in order to become qualified to grade the test. So they do use a variety of methodologies, one including social media, including that does include Craigslist for their recruitment.
Is the company here?
Yes, they are.
Could there, some one of them come up? Because I'd just like to...
Okay.
Good morning. My name is Dave Ernst. I'm with Measure Progress. I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
You're what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
My name is Dave Ernst, and I'm with Measure Progress.
What's your position, if I could ask?
I'm Vice President of Business Development.
Right. Terrific. So here's my question. We have, if not the finest, one of the top public school systems in the country. And it's not just because of our test scores, it's because of our teachers. And if someone is qualified to teach the content of the exam, why aren't they specifically recruited, our Maryland teachers, as the right people to grade it, as opposed to, as the deputy superintendent just said, somebody from a temporary service? Would you like to address it first?
Oh, good.
But one of the issues is the grading needs to take place during the school year, so it is not beneficial to the schools, the students, to take teachers out of the classroom during the school year to grade those assessments.
Do you have anything to add?
Yes. And also, if I may, Doug Strader, I'm the assessment director with MSDE. Also, the materials that are used for scoring are all reviewed and developed by our teachers. So the actual rubrics and so forth that are used by the scores are reviewed by Maryland educators. But again, unfortunately, with the January administration, the window that's required for scoring would require too much time out of the classroom for our teachers. So that's why, for particularly the HSA, we don't rely specifically on Maryland educators. But they are involved in that entire process of developing those materials and benchmark papers which are used for scoring.
But isn't this conceptually an ideal way to get some extra compensation to Maryland teachers? And shouldn't we begin to think creatively about how we can assure that? And because the alternative strikes me as, I have a bachelor's degree, but I wouldn't be very good at scoring tests because that's just not my...
Well, one of our requirements is that people are certified in the area that they're scoring. No offense to you, certainly, Comptroller. We will get you for financial literacy. But anyway, I think, you bring up a good point, and I don't think it's outside of the realm of possibilities that we can't be more creative in the way we think about how we do this. Maybe there are people that want to do this on Saturdays or in the evenings. We can explore that. I don't think it's off the table. I do want to say that we're reticent about having teachers be out of the classroom because obviously teacher time in front of kids is really important. But I think we can think more creatively about it. You raise a good point for us to investigate.
Well, it doesn't sound like there's anything that prevents a teacher from going on Craigslist or registering with Kelly Services to do this part-time. There's nothing that stops them from doing this if they
correct.
Feel they have the time to take hold. And with full disclosure, maybe 20 years ago, I was a recruiter for Kelly Law Services, so just to let you know that I don't have a problem with Kelly Services.
Okay. Yeah. But thank you for sticking up for Maryland teachers, because I think the superintendent brought up a good point that even with the lieutenant governor's suggestion, it's something that ought to be
absolutely
offered as a first.
I totally agree.
First option, I guess.
As long as it doesn't take them out of the class.
And
as you know, I have two grandchildren in the classroom. Yeah. Those teachers are there from 6:30 in the morning until 4 o'clock at night,
absolutely.
And then they go home and work some more. And I think
I agree. I have a daughter that's student teaching right now, and that's her schedule.
Okay, so this is not my only lingering concern on this contract. I think the letter, frankly, or the communication that we got glossed over the issues that Measured Progress has had in states around the country. And I could sit here and quote, as I did last time, media report after media report, with educators and education officials contradicting some of the statements that were made. But rather than me doing that, let me just ask you directly, in an attempt to justify Measured Progress's complete failure in Nevada, you stated in your letter, quote, Nevada has several highly populated districts with significant student counts where scalability of the test delivery system is crucial.
forgive me if I'm a little confused as to what exactly the difference is between Nevada and Maryland, according to those criteria. By my count, Nevada had 460,000 students in 22 districts. When measured progress failed to deliver the test there, Maryland has 880,000 students in 24 districts.
Let me have Dr. Strader address that.
Yeah, the true issue there was the platform itself, and we did extensive research to make sure that the platform that they presented for the Maryland contract can handle that capacity and that load. The issue in Nevada, and Measure Progress can speak to this as well, but through my research and my colleagues in Nevada, the platform that they used was a different platform. It was an AIR open source platform. That's the instrument that students engage the test, the online test. So that's where the issue lied. So within that contract, that's where the bulk of the issue was. With this contract, they've introduced a different platform, which, again, we've done the research and we've confirmed with the states that they've used with that platform that they've had no issues. And that's what we followed up with.
Okay. On the third item, which I'm always presented with when I bring this subject of overtesting up, is, oh, it's the federal government. We don't really like the overtesting either, and we understand it interferes with the joy of teaching, and we are, yes, all in favor of accountability, but this fetish with testing is not our priority. It's the federal government that is demanding it, and if we don't do it, we're somehow going to lose federal funding. So my question is, apparently Nevada, Montana, and North Dakota, because of all measured progress's clients, 95% of the students in those three states did not take the test due to measured progress's failures. Did either of those three states, Nevada, Montana, or North Dakota, lose federal funding? Anybody know?
So when situations like this occur, the federal government requires the states to go through a plan of action and how they're addressing this and how they can assure things like this don't happen in future cases. I don't believe that funding was pulled for that year because the intent was to assess all kids, but the state of Nevada, as well as other states that do have issues, do have to provide assurances to you and said that this won't happen again and go into great detail of how they're wishing to, how they're going to need to address that in future administrations.
Well, and are there states that have had their federal education funding cut because of this threat of we have to do this even though we don't like all of the details of it because the federal government's going to fine us otherwise? Has that ever happened?
Actually, when I was in New York as superintendent, 46% of the students in my district did not take the state test. And subsequent to that, there were letters sent out, and I did leave and come back to Maryland, thank goodness. And there were letters sent out that funding was going to be restricted because they did not meet the 95% participation. So it has happened, not as extensively as probably we would think that it would, but it has happened in some jurisdictions.
Okay. Well, I continue to be skeptical about this contract, and I'm not convinced that Measured Progress is capable of fulfilling their end of the deal. And so with all due respect, I'm going to vote against it, as I have. And I just don't like outsourcing this responsibility to out-of-state contractors with highly questionable qualifications, and particularly on the scoring. And I hear what the treasurer said, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about making it available to Maryland teachers as a first option. And then if you have certain polls, because some teachers don't want to earn extra income voluntarily by working on the weekends doing the scoring, then you can go to the lieutenant governor's Kelly services, I guess, but not the other way around. Let's offer this first and foremost, if at a minimum, if this contract is approved, Madam Superintendent, make sure the teachers get right of first refusal.
We'll certainly work on that, and I appreciate your ideas.
Okay, questions? All right, well, thank you. Any other questions on this Any other questions on this budget?
I have to say, Madam Superintendent, I just was reminded of my mother-in-law, who every time I offered good advice, Comptroller would say, "We'll take that under advisement."
Yes, ma'am.
Respond after the advice. Yeah. That's a question.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other questions on budget management agenda?
No, so I would would move the agenda without item 8, and then if that could be considered separately.
Okay. We want a motion on item 8 alone.
You make the motion?
I will make the motion.
We have a second.
So that is approved 2-1.
Okay.
Now, a motion on the entire agenda?
Except 2.
Except for what was withdrawn and item 8, which was done separately.
Move approval. Okay.
Second? Yeah, we're moving forward. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. University system.
Mr. Evans is here.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 3 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
Okay. I think that's we'll wait to let some of the here. There's a lot of people were here for budget and management. Okay. I just have a, and maybe it's not necessarily a question on 1LT, the lease in Hagerstown. I haven't been out to the facility. I have been to, I guess, a similar regional concept that you have at Shady Grove, the universities at Shady Grove, I believe it's called.
Correct.
And is this is a similar concept in Hagerstown?
Yes, it is, sir. I have Mark Halsey, who is the executive director for USM Hagerstown, here to bring him up to answer.
Please.
Good morning. And, yes, it is the second of 2 regional higher ed centers that are part of the system.
Okay. I think we need you to reintroduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Mark Halsey, H-A-L-S-E-Y. I'm the executive director of the University System of Maryland at Hagerstown.
Thank you.
And which 6 university system campuses are involved?
We have Salisbury, Towson, University College, College Park, Frostburg, and Coppin.
Okay. And this one is for Eastern Shore.
This one is for Eastern Shore.
Right.
The approval was given by the commission, so that program will be starting in the fall.
Okay. Now, is this on West Washington? Is this right downtown where the revitalization of Hagerstown is?
Exactly. It's exactly across the street from our current facility. And it is part of this larger renovation project that will tie together with the Maryland Theater, with the Washington County new academic building, and the plaza that will be built all on the opposite side of the street of Washington.
Yeah, I think the Maryland Theater was on the agenda last week, I believe. Was it a bond bill?
Yes, it was, absolutely. Okay. From Hagerstown. A lot of good news going on.
Good
in Hagerstown.
Good things in Hagerstown.
The Barbara Ingram School, is that? The Barbara Ingram School, do you all do anything with it?
Barbara Ingram School is here, and then the Maryland Theater is here, and there's a deserted building in between that will be torn down. That building will be the Barbara Ingram expansion, essentially. There'll be a 4-story public school expansion. And then there will be a sky bridge that will connect through the back, what is now a parking lot, will become the plaza. That will connect to the rear of the building that we're proposing to lease. So that students, rather than going outside and down the street will essentially have a glass hallway to change classes with, because they will be taking their science classes permanently with us, and then we'll be using our first story building, or the first story of the building, for lunch.
That's great. That's a great model.
Yes, sir.
Yes, just following up on the Lieutenant Governor's question about the seven university system schools that are offering programs, how many current students are enrolled in classes at Hagerstown?
Approximately 500.
500. And how many students per year go on to get their degrees through participation in the programs offered? And do you have a sense of what kind of degrees people are pursuing?
Well, the model is for people to come into the center already with approximately 60 credit hours or an associate's degree. So they will be transferring, whether it's from a community college or some other institution, but the large majority are the two fairly local community colleges, certainly local, in Hagerstown Community College plus Frederick Community College. Those students then come in and do a bachelor's degree. We also have master's programs and one doctoral program. The origin of the bachelor's programs for those pursuing a master's, I could get back to you. I don't know precisely. But
how many of the 500 students, how many get degrees this year?
This year we will be graduating just over 100 students. We've had up through last year, I don't have this May's number yet because, you know, graduation hasn't been announced yet. But through last May, we've graduated 1,717 students.
Total.
Total. Since we opened in the spring of 2005.
Do you have a graduation ceremony, or do they go back to the home school?
We have a celebration of graduation.
Okay.
Students officially graduate and are certainly invited and encouraged to go back to their home campuses. For many of our students, they have never been to their home campus. So we have a dinner and a celebration and awards, and it feels like and may smell like a graduation. It's actually a celebration of their graduation.
Okay. Well, the Lieutenant Governor gives a mean commencement speech. So.
We need to talk.
Love to do it. So, yeah. Any other questions for the university system?
What's the time frame for the?
I'm sorry?
The time frame for the completion of all this?
Completion will be approximately a year. So they've already done the demolition, so they'll start construction basically upon your approval and assigning the lease. Payment will not happen until we actually get occupancy, and that will be for the first floor, which will be hospitality. We're hoping that we'll be in there by January for the spring semester. And then the STEM labs won't be available probably until approximately April of 2018, or about a year from now.
Great.
Very good.
Graduation speech, 2018.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the university system?
Move approval.
Second. All in favor? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am going to commission at University College this year.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Here?
University of Maryland, University College.
Tokyo.
That would be more fun. Okay, Department of Information Technology. And we have a new person here. Mike Leahy, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Governor. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mike Leahy, the Acting Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have three items on your agenda, and there are personnel here to answer any specific questions you may have.
Okay. I had one question about 3IT, but I think it's been resolved. As I understand, this is a basically a companion to a prior acquisition, and this is the maintenance associated with proprietary software that you already have. So the maintenance would be proprietary as well. When I saw sole source,
that is my understanding also, sir.
That's correct.
That's right. It is over the transportation. So thank you. Any questions on Department of Information Technology?
Move approval.
Sir.
Okay, we're all in favor. So thank you very much again.
Thank you for being welcome.
1,000 right away. Okay. Department of Transportation.
Good morning, members of the board. For the record, my name is Pete Ron, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation. MDOT is presenting 13 items for the board's consideration today.
Thank you.
Governor, good. Do you have anything to say about the purple line?
I do. You know, the president's budget is actually a recommendation to Congress, and Congress establishes the budget and passes it. And so the news this last week was that President Trump's request for a budget did not fund New Starts, and New Starts is the pot of money that we will be receiving funds from for the Purple Line in the amount of $900 million. So there's two issues here. Number one, many presidents have tried to cut New Starts, and it has not succeeded in the past. A very influential member of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Senator Collins, has said that New Starts is not going to be reduced. So I'm fairly confident that we're going to see that program continue. But the better news would be that we get a ruling from Federal Judge Leon, in which we get a ruling now, and we won't be even dealing with that issue in the next fiscal year's budget for the feds. It will come out of the existing federal budget, and we are prepared to start construction within 2 weeks of the federal judge giving us a favorable ruling. So we are proceeding. There are some acquisition of right-of-way or of real estate within your 13 items, and these are the critical pieces that we will have to have in place for the project to move forward. So if the piece is not critical to the path of the project, then we're not pursuing those yet. The ones you have in front of us are the pieces that we're absolutely going to have in place if the federal judge rules in our favor. Ultimately, if the federal judge rules against us in this case, we would have to go to appeals. Appeals would probably take a minimum of 6 months, and we would end up seeing delay costs. But even the delay costs would be less than the cost to cancel. So right now, we're trying to judiciously move forward with the Purple Line and to make those decisions that prepares us for the start of construction.
I can add, too, that in addition to the governor's meeting with Secretary Price on ACA, he is also meeting with Secretary Chow today on a number of our transportation issues, including Purple Line, as well as what to do with NYMATA.
I hear what you say about getting through the district court as quickly as possible. Are we on track to do that? What do your attorneys say?
We don't know is our problem. The final arguments were all submitted in January, and so we are now essentially 2 months into the judge's time to issue his ruling. We are totally at the judge's timeline. We've questioned how could we get messages to the governor or to the judge that, you know, this really is putting a lot of public money at risk. And ultimately, even if I were to send a letter, that could open a process where the plaintiffs could issue a response, and it starts the clock all over. So we are sitting here waiting for the judge's ruling, And we believe if it's based, if the ruling is based on law, we will win.
Thank you. It sounds like you're doing what we can to keep our position. Mm-hmm.
There's been media recently, within the last few days, that has started talking about how much we've already invested of public funds and what a very, I think, a low ball estimate of what cancellation of the contract would cost us. So we are pursuing this diligently within the boundaries of the law, but this project cannot move forward without federal funds.
Thank you.
And thank the Treasurer for bringing that up in the Secretary's comments. With all due respect to the federal court, this is an absolutely critical project. And it's in limbo, unbelievably, over these essentially frivolous issues that lack any real merit. And so, If someone's listening in on this conversation, this is very upsetting to the state of Maryland and highly unusual to have this nonsense hanging out there and not be able to resolve it in an expedited fashion. And I just hope your efforts to deal with the courts will get this issue behind us and allow us to start construction and get the Purple Line trains bringing workers to employment centers and finally having the east-west transportation mode that the Washington region desperately needs, and that we can begin revenue service in the spring of 2022. And, if the judge, with all due respect once again, could just get in his or her car and travel around the region and see the traffic congestion and understand that this system is going to take cars off the road and help workers get to job centers and unleash all sorts of economic development opportunities. And we desperately need to get this project back on track. And right now it's being, it's frozen in limbo. And It's less the cost, and it's more the impact of not moving forward with this project, and that's what I find inexplicable.
Mr. Comptroller, what we have done is, because the judge's order impacted the federal funding, not state funding or state activities, we have continued to do the preliminary work to construction. So we have continued to design, do geotechnical work, acquire right-of-way, and so forth. And so we have been able to do that with state dollars that we will, by the end of the project, we will have reimbursements from local governments as well as the federal government, which is the plan, in which the state's dollars in this project would represent $159 million up front, and then a continuing payment from MDOT over the next 30 years. We've been making progress, but we are rapidly approaching the point at which we will be incurring delays to the contractor moving forward with their planned work.
Well, with all due respect to the courts again, it's wrong to hold this up without a decision. Do your work and make your pronouncement. And if I'm correct and the legal concerns here are frivolous, which I believe they are, do your job. And don't jeopardize the whole project because of inaction.
Any other questions?
Maybe I'll just send that transcript over and try not to generate
it. Judges don't care to be pushed a little bit there. I don't like doctors in that respect. They don't like to be pushed.
Uh-oh. So,
no doctor comments?
No, don't include my orthopedist here. No, that's okay. Thank you for bringing it up, Madam Treasurer, because I think it's a crucial project.
It is very important.
Very frustrated that it's kind of hanging in space.
Right. It's a deliberative process. I have a couple of questions. I don't know if there are others. 4M and 5M. Now, they're road mowing projects, roadside mowing projects. It was interesting to me that there was only one bid for Garrett County, a project, but there were multiple bids for Allegheny County, as well as Washington County. The winner of the Washington County and The Garrett County, there was one bid for Allegheny County, multiple bids for Garrett County as well as Washington County. The winner of the Washington County bid, who is from Baltimore, bid on the Garrett County, but did not bid on Allegheny, which my geography says is closer to Baltimore than Garrett, that we got one bid for Allegheny County. I didn't quite get that. And even the Garrett County contractor probably could have driven to, even though it gets a little, the space gets a little distant there, but could have gotten to.
Governor, I don't have a good explanation for you. Maybe one of our procurement people will. But it's interesting to me to note here. First, I would like to point out that when we got a single bid on this, we went back out to bid. We marketed the project, and we got one bid. And it's interesting that the incumbent didn't even bid on the project. So there's whether they know something about having to work within Allegheny. I don't know what their reasoning was, but we did everything we could to get more than one bid. And for whatever reasons, this is what we have. I don't, Eric, do you know something that I've not explained?
Good morning, Eric Lomboy, Director of Procurement from SHA. We are uncertain of why we're having such difficulties in that area. We split the procurement so that we had it in geographically located, so we have the county separated to try and encourage more competition so that it's encourages small businesses, minority businesses to bid. We went back out, talked to three people that didn't bid and weren't originally solicited, that we knew that could do work in other areas. They chose not to bid the second time around. And we also went with six firms that were on the solicitation list from the first bids, talked to them and solicited basically feedback on why they didn't. Most of them basically said they were either coded wrong in the system, which we're going to look into seeing how that works. So email marketplace pulls up companies based on codes that they put in. So apparently these firms had put their codes in correctly. So they didn't actually do the work that we were looking for them to do. So then we followed with other companies. They were either time issues or capacity. So they didn't have the capacity on additional work to bid in that area as well.
So people are working out in Western Maryland, it sounds like. I mean, at least those businesses are.
Doesn't sound like it to me, because some of these companies aren't even in the grass-cutting business.
Correct.
So why, when they receive, why would that be a surprise to you guys if they're not bidding?
Well, we go by email marketplace coding. We go out to the companies, and then when we don't get enough bids, we do follow up. Now, some of them do say they may not be, you know, they may be construction companies, but they're willing to do mowing. That's part of the business they're expanding
to.
They
put those NAICS codes in.
Correct.
Saying that they can do
correct. And then other ones put them in, but they don't actually do the work. One was, I think, a marketing and advertising firm. Yeah, they had put the code
they
in correctly.
They must have put the wrong code.
Yes. Yeah. So we did our due diligence. It just ended up with the same thing.
Why doesn't your, I mean, really, not to get down in the weeds, but why doesn't your district engineer out there just put something out among his, you know, network of people? I mean, this is not a sophisticated, necessarily, skill. It's
right.
Cutting the grass and landscaping, and there have got to be a lot of people out in Garrett County, similar to Allegheny County. So if I could, I just find it an odd thing to push up as the deciding detail here, something called e-marketplace, which I'm not very familiar with. I'm sure your district engineer knows eight companies probably that cut the grass and might be interested in a contract or at least bidding on it. So I guess I'll bring up, Lieutenant Governor, my
Francho remedy, which is when you get a single bid contract that doesn't make sense, just vote against it and tell them to go back and come up with some bids. I know you've already done it once, but it's not a – I mean, telling me that you guys go to some e-marketplace and rely upon other people's codings and just go out to Garrett County. There are only 6,000, 10,000 people in the whole county.
And I understand, Mr. Comptroller, and with all due respect, we do also directly solicit firms that – and in this case, we did firms that aren't listed there – that we knew were capable. Again, for various reasons, they chose not to. All we can do is market and attempt to get solicitations coming in. We can't force them.
Maybe the Lieutenant Governor's right and everybody's working over there and they're too busy to go after a $200,000 contract. I tend not to believe that, and because I visit Western Maryland a lot, like he does, but that is an area that's economically challenged. And cutting the grass is, well, when does this contract start?
It starts in April.
Well,
the Secretary wanted to.
Two things, Mr. Comptroller. One is that it's not mowing grass like you picture.
I understand.
Right? You need specialized equipment to mow the grass. You also have to have traffic control, and you have to have all of that in place before you can send your tractor out with its blades to start cutting. And it's also trimming trees and those sorts of things that all go. I guess it's not trimming trees, is it?
It's brush.
Brush. And so who knows why, whether they didn't think it was enough money to incorporate all of the processes you go through to mow these particular lanes. But there's truly a safety issue here, and that the reason this starts in April is we need to get the roadways cut, and so that it doesn't attract more animals that like to jet out in front of traffic, and it really is important to us to keep our right-of-way down.
What's the date today?
So this is April. This starts in April.
Yeah, and what's the date today?
Yeah, I mean, it's the 22nd or whatever.
Yeah, 22nd of March. Nobody's going to be cutting grass initially in April because there's still snow on the ground out there. That's okay. I understand that. But why couldn't you just rebid this to the Allegheny folks? They're right next door.
Can I clarify for the record to the transcript? Oh,
this is the
transcript was correct. There were three bids for Garrett County. There were three bids for Washington County. It is Allegheny County. In the middle that there was only one bid in Allegheny.
Okay.
That's why it's odd because you have the bids further out and you have the bids closer in. And
so we're being asked to vote on three separate or just
there
one?
There are three separate items. One is for Garrett, and you got three bids.
Okay, well, I'll just cut to the chase. Have me vote against Allegheny and for the other two, and I'll let my objection just ride.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions on this agenda? Questions. I have a quick question, and this goes to, it's not, it's somewhat related to State Highway, but not, and this is a question for Sheila, you may know this. Why is it, and we should have taken this up in our procurement commission, why is it that State Highway and Maryland Transportation Authority do not have to bring their road projects to the Board of Public Works?
That was just from a long time ago when they set up the procurement system in the 70s, and it is so that Secretary Ron could award construction contracts and get the construction going, the horizontal construction going on the highways. Of course, as you know, the a design of the highways has to come in. The purchase for the property of the highways, everything has to come here, except it has just always been from the beginning. The State Roads Commission would still award the construction contracts even when the Board of Public Works was given everything. So it's all throughout our
I think that's part two of our commission to really look at that.
Yeah, it is
I could be a real skeptic and think because road commissions historically in this country have not had the best reputation in the world. So historically. Not now, but, you know, when you had these things, road commissions, those were the plum jobs in a lot of places because they were very cozy with contractors. That's historic. And so in a lot of states, maybe not Maryland, but a lot of states it was like
that. To be clear, the construction of these highways is subject to all procurement laws. They have to follow all the procurement laws except their
they just don't have the oversight of the board.
As compared to some other things that are exempt from the procurement law, but you might review them.
Right.
So he is, I say, trust following all procurement laws with the state construction of highways, just not bringing them to you, and that's been the law since...
Does the law say you can't bring it to the Board of Public Works?
It excludes them.
Specifically?
It specifically excludes them.
Doesn't that go back to the Baltimore subway contracts?
Well, actually, I think it probably does go back a little earlier before that, but I think that
And I was remiss in not raising that in our commission.
That might be another year, commission.
All right. Let's see. Do we have a motion on 4M, that is the Allegheny County maintenance contract?
I would move to approve it.
Okay, and I'll second that. So that's 2-1 on that. And then the remainder of transportation's agenda, absent of work. Okay, second. We're all in favor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Absolutely.
I thought about this later. It was after.